The headlines: an Israeli minister confirms the secret visit of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Saudi Arabia, calling it an amazing achievement. The European Commission warns France that news media must be able to work freely amid anger over controversial French draft law that bans publishing police images. And a new study finds that Britain's private sector economic activity shrank in November to a five-month low on fresh coronavirus restrictions. This is News. Thanks for joining us. A member of the Israeli cabinet has confirmed that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited Saudi Arabia over the weekend. Netanyahu's Education Minister Yoav Gallant told Israeli media that the premier met with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Gallant called the meeting an amazing achievement and one of a kind between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Riyadh has denied any meeting between Netanyahu and bin Salman. Earlier, the Israeli media released aviation tracking data on a business jet which traveled from Tel Aviv to the Saudi coastal city of Neom. The report said that the jet was carrying Netanyahu as well as the Mossad chief, Yossi Cohen. The meeting is seen as the U.S. administration's last-ditch push for normalization of ties between Tel Aviv and Riyadh. Political analyst Elijah Magnier says that Israel and Saudi Arabia have had regular contacts for years.
I think it's very far from being an achievement. The relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel is not new. The contact between the two are very regular since ages. It's coming out now, but it serves different purposes. First of all, in my opinion, I think it is an adverse to Neom, mega city that is planned by Mohammed bin Salman. It's a $500 billion plan. It's also a support for Netanyahu's domestic crisis. We saw how one of his aides said, while Netanyahu is making peace, Benny Gantz, the defense minister, is playing politics because Netanyahu is accused of corruption and Benny Gantz wants to open an investigation into the corrupted deal of the submarine and naval deal that Israel did, and Netanyahu has been accused of corruption many times.
Israel has sent its first delegation to Sudan after they announced an agreement to normalize their ties last month. Sources said the members of the delegation held talks with the chairman of Sudan's Sovereign Council on Monday. It was not immediately clear who is on the delegation. For days, there have been rumors of a first Israeli visit to Khartoum on the heels of the October agreement that was brokered by the U.S. President Donald Trump. The deal followed similar U.S. brokered deals Bahrain and the UAE signed in September to normalize relations with Israel. The move drew strong criticism from the Palestinians and the rest of the Muslim world. Palestinians condemned the normalization deals as a stab in the back. The Yemeni military says it has targeted an Aramco oil distribution station in Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says the targeted facility is located in the Red Sea city of Jeddah. He said the attack was a legitimate response to what he described as Saudi crimes and aggression against Yemen. The spokesman also warned foreign companies working in Saudi Arabia to exercise caution as operations will continue. Saudi authorities have refrained from reacting to the news. Reports say that oil production in the facility has come to a halt. Political commentator Jason Onruha says the Yemeni army's retaliatory attack shows that the war has become unwinnable for Saudi Arabia.
National budget is one of them. How long do they want to continue dumping resources into what is essentially a failed effort? Nothing good for Saudi Arabia has materialized out of this. I mean, they've even suffered a significant amount of damage to their own oil production from retaliatory strikes from the Yemenis. They haven't made a single dollar off of this entire endeavor, which is generally what imperialist war is about. It's about getting hold of resources, access to markets, cheaper labor, etc. But none of this has materialized for them. This entire endeavor has been one monumental loss. The other factors which are particular to this case are the political will to continue, you know, this entire war. I mean, it's all been for nothing, and that's eventually going to take its toll politically on the royal family, the political establishment, etc. How much are they willing to throw away, and how much of their ego, or how much are they going to attempt to save face? Because this is very humiliating. This is something they thought was going to be a quick in-and-out job, and they would have Yemen, but it's been going on for years now, and they've made no significant inroads. They've not really made any major capturing, so it's really a question of whether or not the Saudis are really going to just eventually admit defeat. And I don't think, given their previous efforts, that it's coming anytime soon.
The European Commission has warned France the news media must be able to work freely. It comes amid growing anger over a draft law that bans publishing police images. The Commission's spokesman stressed that any legislation by EU member states must ensure the freedom of expression for both citizens and the media. Christian Wiegand said the bloc reserves itself the right to examine the final legislation to verify its conformity with its laws. The security law effectively criminalizes publication of photos and videos of French police officers while on duty. Press groups and media unions staged mass protests against the law over the weekend. They say the legislation makes France a police state by preventing documentation of abuses committed by security forces. The UK economy shrinks as a new national lockdown shuts services firms, while the news of possible COVID-19 vaccines has boosted hopes for 2021. The return of restrictions has pushed the Composite Purchasing Managers Index, which shows private sector growth, to the lowest since June. The decline is smaller than the forecast shown in polls and less severe in the Eurozone. Britain's economy is widely expected to contract in the fourth quarter, but less than it did when around the time of the first coronavirus lockdown. Forecasts also say that the manufacturing sector will continue to accelerate at a healthy pace. New lockdowns have slammed the brakes on the budding recovery in the service sector, reducing Christmas shoppers by half compared to the year before. Thousands of Kashmiris are living in a constant fear of death and destruction amid continued hostility between India and Pakistan on the line of control, dividing the disputed Himalayan region. Of course, Manashan Abad has traveled to a village on the Indian side of the de facto border and has filed this report.
Some 120 kilometers from Srinagar, the summer capital of Indian-administered Kashmir, lies Uri. The line of control that divides Kashmir into two parts and ruled by India and Pakistan runs through this area of Baramulla district of Indian-held Kashmir. After trekking around 10 to 15 minutes, you reach the Smurthal village, which is frequently a target of India-Pakistan animosity. Parviz Ahmed's house was completely destroyed in the recent India-Pakistan face-off, although his family was lucky enough to survive this devastating attack.
This is not new for the people who live near the LOC, but this time it was a rain of artillery. Years of my toil is wasted. I and my family of five are homeless now in this winter. The fire even burned the food stock that I had stocked up for the winter months.
Weeks have passed since the incident. Parvez is still waiting for help and relief work to begin.
We have repeatedly asked the government to build bunkers for the people living in this area. The government is not paying attention to our needs.
Government officials told Press TV that the Jammu and Kashmir administration is working on a project to construct 44 bunkers for people living along the line of control. They said that another project for building some 250 individual bunkers is underway.
Whenever we go to government officials with a request, they often turn us away. Many times they say, go and seek help from Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Whatever is being said about help and relief is a media stunt, a part of which might reach us but too late.
For decades, Kashmiris have been bearing the brunt of India-Pakistan animosity. The two countries have fought two of their three wars over Kashmir, which they rule in parts but claim in its entirety. Kashmir has lost tens of thousands of people after the armed struggle against Indian rule began in 1989. India accuses Pakistan of training and sending fighters into Indian side of Kashmir, something Pakistan denies but says it only supports the idea of free and unified Kashmir, politically and diplomatically. The question that remains is how long will Parvez and many others like Parvez wait for government's assistance? Can they survive this harsh winter without a proper shelter? And how long will it take the world to stand for the resolution of this long-pending dispute without further destruction? Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Okay, I guess we're going to talk about Sudan. Mohamed Fazari joins us from Khartoum to tell us about the latest. Mohamed, over to you.
Yeah, great. We hear today that is the delegation, Israeli delegation, visit Khartoum and meet with the President of Supreme Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and discussed many issues regarding the steps taken by Khartoum last month about how normalization, mutual ties between Khartoum and Tel Aviv. But from the government side, no comments from the Sudanese government about such a visit. And we know this visit is scheduled to be on the 15th of this November, but has been delayed for a few days, but without any confirmation from the government from Sudan or the Israel. But for sure, the meeting was took place on a high level of military side of the government. Still, the civilian side was not informed about this visit because there is a split among the Sudanese government, the civilian and the military, about how normalizing ties with Israel. As you know that the key parties of the Sudanese government coalition, which is Forces of Freedom and Change, most party categorically rejected any kind of normalizing ties with Israel. That's why the issues of Israel delegation is always takes place in high confidentiality and in a secret way, that people, they don't have any information about what is going on between the Sudanese government and the Israeli government. But for sure, the normalization is something that is highly rejected in many Sudanese parties, whether the Islamist or the Arab nationalist parties. They are totally disagree such rapprochement or any kind of relation with Israel. This start relation between Sudan and Israel on February this year, when General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan visited Uganda and met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The visit, which he provokes anger in Sudanese political parties, and which he says that the Sudanese government has no mandate to discuss such normalizing relations because it is not elected government and it does not express the will of the Sudanese people. Other parties think such things should be based on legislative council or the parliament so that to be approved, because the Sudanese constitutional document stipulated very clear that any relation should be based on the mutual interest, and they think that there is no mutual interest between Sudan and Israel. And for sure, this bore in mind of the Sudanese people that the capital, Khartoum, was known for sure that the capital of three no's: no for peace, no for negotiation, and no recognition of Israel. This is become like stab of the Sudanese parties, that is a historic party, I mean Umma National Party and the Communist Party, which support the Palestinian issues and the Palestinian people, their right to live in their state. And many people think that Israel is an occupying regime and has no right to deal with the Sudanese government, particularly this traditional government, which has a very clear task and very clear mandate, which is not to involve in normalizing relations with Israel.
Thank you very much for that. I'm Mohammed Fazari there, talking to us from Khartoum. Many thanks. In its latest show of military might, Iran has unveiled a new ocean-going warship with cutting-edge weaponry and technologies on board. This comes as tensions between Tehran and Washington have risen to an all-time high, with reports indicating that the U.S. was mulling over a military strike on Iran. Tehran has warned the U.S. of a crushing response in the event of such aggression.
The naval fleet of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently received a new domestically built ocean-going warship capable of carrying aircraft, drones, and missile defense systems. The heavyweight multipurpose vessel, which has been designed for long sea journeys, joined the IRGC's Navy during a ceremony on Thursday. The 4,000-ton warship, which is 150 meters long and 22 meters wide, can carry drones, helicopters, and operational vessels, as well as missile, air defense, and radar systems. It is named Shahid Rudaki Warship after martyred IRGC Navy Commander Abdullah Rudaki. The vessel is equipped with three-dimensional phased array radars, surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missiles, advanced communication systems for electronic warfare, and a Khordad 3 air defense system, all of which are designed and put into operation by Iranian experts.
The main issue for the armed forces is to be strong enough to defend the country and to retaliate any possible attack against Iran. So that is part of that. And since we have the Persian Gulf and actually the Caspian Sea and south and north of Iran. It has been very important to have a good and powerful navy.
Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsiri, commander of Iran's IRGC Navy, said the vessel can carry out combat, logistical, and intelligence-gathering missions in the ocean aimed at establishing stable security in maritime transportation lines and providing assistance to the commercial and fishing fleets belonging to the Islamic Republic and regional countries.
Well, in recent years, Iran has made major breakthroughs when it comes to different areas, in this particularly defense sector. And it has attained self-sufficiency in producing important military equipment and hardware, which run the gamut from manned and unmanned aircraft to advanced missiles, vessels, and submarines. This comes amid heightened tensions between the United States and Iran, which were already growing since Washington unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal 2 years ago. Reports are surfacing that U.S. President Donald Trump has been contemplating attacking Iran's nuclear facilities. Now, how does such a scenario benefit the president, who is already grappling with a political crisis at home?
U.S. President Donald Trump's new acting defense secretary, Christopher Miller, said last week that Washington will be cutting the number of its deployed troops to Afghanistan and Iraq to 5,000 from 7,500 forces that are currently present there. Just days later, however, the U.S. Central Command said in a statement that two B-52 bombers were deployed to West Asia on short notice to deter what it called potential aggression and reassure U.S. partners and allies in the region. That comes after the New York Times said in a report that Trump had asked his close allies what options were available to take action against Iran's main nuclear site at Natanz. The report adds that the advisors warned the president that a military action could spark a broader conflict in the region.
There have been times that Iran and the United States have been much closer to a war between themselves. So it's not a tough situation right now. The tension is high to some extent, but it's not that high that we would be worried about any possible war. But the United States know that it's not capable of attacking Iran and doing a war. Because we have seen for 20 years the situation in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and the United States was not capable of fighting against those countries completely, and we were introduced to endless wars because of those two countries. So let alone Iran, which is actually much more powerful and much bigger than those countries.
Some experts are now questioning how such an attack would help Donald Trump while the United States is dealing with political uncertainty over who will control the White House for the next 4 years following a contested election. Donald Trump announced the United States' withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran by unilaterally reimposing sanctions on the country. His stance on Iran has been repeatedly criticized internationally, including even by the closest U.S. allies. But Tehran has warned that any aggression by the U.S. against Iran, be it Trump's attempt to distract the American public in the aftermath of the November 3rd election, or an excuse to stay in power, will certainly be met with a crushing response.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, patience instead of complaining. We all face challenges. Some give into challenges and others complain. And there are some who observe patience, which is called sabr. The linguistic meaning of sabr and patience is confinement, while its meaning in the Sharia in Islam is to continue the soul to, you know, confining our soul to obedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and avoidance of disobeying Him and not getting angry at the decree of Allah and His predestination. As for the saying of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which means, so be patient with gracious patience. This is chapter 70, verse number 5. Allah Almighty says, so be patient with gracious patience. This means a patience without grief. Allah says to him, be patient over the harm of those polytheists to you
and the harm that you find from them should not prevent you from conveying the message of Allah, which He has ordered for you to convey. And this was, you know, primarily sent for the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He faced so many tribulations and trials and challenges in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And Allah advised him to be patient. And this is a lesson for all of us, to be patient in the way of Allah. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing patience instead of complaining. Some people choose to complain. Others, they are patient over challenges and trials. Complaining is not something that they sign up for. There is nothing in Allah's commandment to His Prophet that when He says with gracious patience, that implies that it is an order from Allah to him in some circumstances only. Rather, this was the commandment of Allah to him in all circumstances. Because since the Prophet was sent as a prophet until he died, he faced harm from them. And he was patient in the face of all the harm that he faced from the disbelievers before Allah gave him permission to fight them. And after his permission to him to do so, that is, perform jihad. Brothers and sisters, patience means resistance. And it is not a selective patience, that we are patient in some fields, but when it comes to some other challenges, some other, you know, trials, we end up losing patience. No, patience means resisting in the face of these challenges, especially when they're in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So imagine you're trying to live a life of an obedient, good Muslim. Right, you wear hijab, you do your prayers, so on and so forth, and you face challenges from the secular minded people around you, from the liberal minded people around you. What do you do in the face of these challenges? Well, one option is to just drop whatever you're doing and be like them. Well, guess what? Islam says no. You have to be patient, you have to be resistant, and you have to keep doing the right thing no matter how many challenges you face. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Don. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss what the normalizations of relations with Israel means for people and government of Bangladesh. And we shall also take a look at reactions of other nations across the subcontinent to the normalization deal with Israel.
The news of agreements on the normalization of relations between Israel and some Arab countries shocked the whole world. Apart from Pakistan and India, the largest and perhaps strongest subcontinental countries with higher stakes in the geopolitics of the region, there were reactions from other nations across the subcontinent. One of the ramifications of the US brokered deal is that countries feel pressed to calibrate their ties and priorities vis-a-vis Palestine and Israel.
With more than 150 million Muslims, Bangladesh is one of the most vocal countries about the Palestinian rights. Therefore, the news of the normalization deal with Israel was met with fury and fire.
People of Bangladesh, I think most of the people, even 100% people support the cause of the Palestinian people from the very tradition, historically, they support the cause of Bangladesh. And I didn't find any person against the Palestinians or supporting the Israel's stand, and that's why I didn't find any difference of opinion on this issue, that the cause of the Palestinians should be properly upheld.
Despite the lack of direct hostilities, Israel and Bangladesh have no economic, defense or diplomatic ties. However, Bangladeshi-Palestinian solidarity goes well beyond history and politics. Father of the nation, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, was one of the supporters of independence for Palestine and even called it immoral to normalize relations with Israel without an independent Palestine. The world is divided in two, the exploiter and the exploited. We are in favor of the exploited. The people of Bangladesh are always beside the Palestinian people, Bangabandhu said.
People of Bangladesh didn't like this thing, that attempt, because the cause of the Palestinians is weakening because of that stand of some stand taken by the Arab countries to normalize this stand. Relation with Israel.
Back in 1972, Israel offered to recognize newly founded Bangladesh that was rejected without a second thought by Tajuddin Ahmed, the then premier of the country, which in 2021 will be 50 years old.
Despite a firm no to any overt or covert relation with Israeli regime, It is found in the recent years that Bangladeshi products are exported to the regime through the US or the European Union or other third countries. The global capitalism has made it possible for a few to benefit from such relations. But how can the Israeli regime ever be a friend of any Muslim country, as the regime preaches intolerance towards Islam?
Given the common feeling in the Muslim majority of Bangladesh, it seems impossible for the government to have any kind of relations with Israel or even welcome the Israeli government with the UAE and Bahrain. But no matter how suicidal for the government and Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, there are a number of Bangladeshi contractors, businessmen, sweatshop owners, or immigration middlemen who seek to manipulate the natural course and discourse of the country to make benefit from the normalization of ties with Israel.
People of Bangladesh very strongly suffer because of the Palestinians, and is very much inherent in their thinking, feeling. So people of the government of Bangladesh will not go against the will of the people of this country, because Bangladesh is a country which always stands for justice, and the cause of the Palestinians has very just claim. So I think Bangladesh will continue to support the cause of the Palestinians and will not normalize the relation with Israel against the will of the people.
Normal people never give up the Palestinian hopes for money or under US or Saudi threats, but there are those who are willing to sacrifice all noble causes for profit. For them, sweatshop productions for the West shouldn't stop. Natural gas and ecological resources should keep flowing to India, and the human labor business in the Persian Gulf Arab countries must flourish. This way, they make sure the Bangladeshi government or people cannot disturb the signatories of the so-called Abraham Accord.
Let's just take a look at how the global media has covered the issue.
Israel's limited diplomacy in South Asia helped it when Nepal and Bhutan abstained during the voting of UN General Assembly Resolution 3379, which described Israel's founding philosophy of Zionism as equivalent to racism. This resolution basically equaled Zionism with apartheid of South Africa, causing international isolation of the Jewish state. India, despite being a secret recipient of Israeli military support during 1962 and subsequently, had supported the resolution on November 10, 1975. Netanyahu gave up on the legal enactment of annexation, but he is still pursuing the process of annexation, perpetuating complete domination over the West Bank and its residents, Michael Sfard, a lawyer who advises human rights groups in Israel, said. The UAE have not received any assurance that Israel will not expand settlements, establish new ones, or consolidate the Israeli bureaucracy in the territory, he added. Although Nepal was the first South Asian country to establish diplomatic relations with Israel, and the two enjoy a strong relationship, Kathmandu says it recognizes the rights of the Palestinians. The Nepali government has voted in favor of Palestine recognition and against the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital at the United Nations, but has always tried not to appear against the US or Israel, as the country is constantly under threats of aid cut by the US authorities. After voting in favor of a UN General Assembly resolution criticizing the US move to shift its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Nepali officials defended their decision as consistent with the country's historic position on Israel and Palestine and not exactly against Washington. Bhutan is one of those countries who have stopped taking any steps in the direction of accepting the existence of Israel as a nation. Israel doesn't seem to be a particularly high priority for Thimphu, as the kingdom has no diplomatic relations, even with its northern neighbor, China.
The proponents of the Israeli formalization say that the deal immediately stops the annexation of the West Bank. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has shattered their illusion. Such an agreement can never put restraint on the expansionist Israeli policies, but would further help the Israeli regime expand beyond the land it has already occupied. There are numerous reports about clandestine relations with Israel, but most countries never dared to tarnish their image with association to the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime. However, the agreement for formal recognition of diplomatic ties by the UAE and Bahrain can serve as a pilot operation devised by the US and Saudi Arabia to check the global response and encourage others to follow suit.
Like many countries that cannot bear the stigma of formal ties with Israel, Maldives has had an on-again, off-again relations with the Zionist regime. The Muslim country established diplomatic relations with Israel in 1965 and suspended them in 1974. In 2009, under President Mohamed Nasheed, the Maldives signed cooperation agreements with Israel on tourism, health, and education and culture. However, the renewed relationship did not develop into full diplomatic relations. In July 2014, under President Abdullah Yameen, the Maldives terminated the cooperation agreements with Israel and announced a boycott of Israeli products as Israel launched a military operation in Gaza. Following the announcement of the agreement with Israel, the Maldivian foreign minister expressed support for the Palestinians and denied having talks with Israel. Dunya Mamun underscored that Male would fully back Palestine at international forums such as the United Nations Human Rights Council. Sri Lankan's ties with Israel follow a similar path. President Jayawardene established ties with Israel. They were suspended under President Premadasa but restored in 2000. In February this year, Israel offered Sri Lanka technology in various sectors, which was welcomed by the newly elected President Rajapaksa. But in June, the Sri Lankan government raised concerns over the human rights situation in Palestine and called on Israel to halt annexation activities in the occupied territories.
Now, to learn more about this issue, we are joined by Mr. Zafar Bangash. He is the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Mr. Bangash, welcome to the subcontinent. So, how much do you think the people of the subcontinent support the Palestinian cause?
The people of the subcontinent are overwhelmingly in favor of the Palestinian people's struggle for self-determination. There are, of course, many reasons for that. These relate to the fact that when we talk about Muslims, for instance, for them, Palestine, the Holy Land, as well as Al-Quds, Masjid Al-Aqsa, hold enormous spiritual significance. Secondly, for them, Palestine is also important because it is closely linked in the minds of the people in the subcontinent with the struggle of the people of Kashmir. And both struggles obviously date back to the same time, back to 1947, and the same colonialist power, Britain, that was behind these intrigues that have caused such enormous suffering both to the Palestinian people as well as the people of Kashmir. So this is, first of all, on the Muslim, from the Muslim perspective. There is also, of course, another factor, and that is that the people of the subcontinent are, generally speaking, quite well informed about international relations, unlike, for instance, people in the Middle East. And of course, they have governments over there that are very oppressive, that do not allow the people to express their views. But the people of the subcontinent are not only quite free to express their views, also, they are not afraid to express their views and to express their sentiments. So all of these factors combined go towards heightening the awareness as well as the concern of the people of the subcontinent towards the struggle of the Palestinian people as well as the liberation of Palestine.
Okay, so you're saying that the issue is similar to the Kashmir issue, and Muslims particularly are in overwhelming support of the Palestinian people. And there are reports that in the 1980s, thousands of Bangladeshi youth volunteered to fight for the Palestinian Liberation Organization. what is behind such massive support for Palestine? Can we say that they understand the settler colonial project, since they themselves lived under colonial rule?
Well, there is no doubt that the experience of the people of the subcontinent under colonialism has played a significant role in shaping their thinking. But I think we need to keep in mind that the struggle for Palestine, or the support of the people of the subcontinent for the struggle in Palestine, as well as other Islamic causes. For instance, in the 1920s, there was what came to be called the Khilafat movement, when the Turks abolished the Ottoman Khilafa. There was a massive movement in the subcontinent at the time, although it was under British colonialism, but people were extremely angry with that, and they wanted to struggle, go to Turkey and to strive to see if the Khilafah could be saved. So there is a very long history in the subcontinent of people's awareness. And of course, they also realized that colonialism has played a very negative and destructive role in many of these areas, whether it's in Palestine, in Kashmir, in Cyprus, you know, a number of other places in the world. And so there is a deep understanding and appreciation of the struggle of people for justice and for their fundamental rights. And that is what explains their deep attachment, even though I don't think we should look at it from a nationalistic point of view, because the people in the subcontinent, especially the Muslims, of course, they look upon themselves as being part of one ummah, and that is what they express in terms of their empathy and support for the Palestinian cause.
Mr. Pankaj, before we take the next question, let's just take a look at how the global media has covered the issue.
There are hundreds of Bangladeshis who fought for Palestinian self-determination and are buried in Palestinian Liberation Organization PLO graves in Lebanon. During the 1982 Lebanon War, 400 Bangladeshi fighters were captured by the Israeli military. Fatih Abu al-Iradat, a PLO secretary, estimated around 1,000 to 1,500 Bangladeshi fighters were involved in the war. In 1987, the Bangladeshi government estimated that around 8,000 Bangladeshi youths had volunteered to fight for the PLO following Arafat's visit to the country. It should be clear that Bangladesh is not against Jews. It is only against Israel's occupation of Palestine. Bangladesh generously recognized few Jews for their contribution to Bangladesh. Among them, General J.F.R. Jacob, architect Louis I. Kahn, are mentionable. Jewish military officer Jacob played a vital role in providing military assistance to Bengali guerrillas in 1971. He was recognized as a friend of liberation war by Bangladesh. The famous Jewish architect Louis I. Kahn, who designed our visually pleasing parliament building, is remembered warmly here in Dhaka. Export Promotion Bureau EPB data shows that in fiscal year 2012 to 2013, Bangladesh has exported goods worth about $22,435 to Israel, while in 2011 to 2012, the amount was $8,364. The maximum amount of exports took place in 2011, when export earning fetched $30,545. And in 2009 to 2010, the amount was $17,861. During these years under review, Bangladesh mainly exported apparel, knit and textile products to Israel. Besides garments items, some ceramic items were also exported. Israel imported $17,571 and $26,558 in 2012 and 2013, respectively.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Bangash, and welcome back to the audience as well. So, Mr. Bangash, you said that there's a long history of colonial rule, and that certainly has an impact on the way things run in the subcontinent. Would the normalization of relations between some Arab countries and Israel impact the geopolitics of the subcontinent?
Yes, this is true that most of the countries of the subcontinent have very close ties with the Persian Gulf countries as well as Saudi Arabia. And then you have India, which is the largest of the countries in the region, that has also very deep ties with the Zionist state of Israel. Now, as far as the people are concerned, I don't think that they will support any normalization with the Zionist occupying regime, because for them, Palestine, Al-Quds, and Masjid Al-Aqsa are very dear to them, and they will continue to strive and struggle regardless of how their governments conduct their affairs. Of course, you know, in the subcontinent, these governments are, or these countries are to a large extent dependent on their expatriate labor force in the Persian Gulf countries. But I think when it comes to the crunch, I think the governments, and I can say this quite safely with respect to Pakistan, for instance, it will not compromise on this principle. India, of course, already has compromised, but I'm not suggesting that the people or the overwhelming majority of people in India have accepted that policy. But in Pakistan, I can say with great confidence that both the people and the government will not compromise on the issue of Palestine. Now, of course, for the people, they have a sentimental attachment to Palestine. For the government, it also has a political dimension in the sense that if the government of Pakistan were to accept normalization of relations with the Zionist state of Israel, then it would have to accept that India's occupation of Kashmir is legitimate. And that's something that Pakistan simply will not accept. And so we see that even though there may be challenges and difficulties for governments in the subcontinent, as far as the people are concerned, they simply will not compromise.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bangladesh, for being with us on our show. It was nice having you here. Let's see how people on social media see this situation.
As a Nepalese, Irmak Aidoya declares his support for the Palestinians and considers the Israeli regime as the worst threat to security. This tweet provides a very brief overview of Sri Lanka-Palestine relations. This user shares some pictures of the Palestinians in the West Bank. And finally, let's take a look at the picture shared by Shadi describing the current situation of Gaza and the Palestinians.
And that was our episode covering the reactions of different nations across the subcontinent to the recognition of Israel. We'll meet next week.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.